The following was recorded at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
Unrest in Washington, D.C. today, and a perspective from a German witness of American democracy.
Everybody is exhausted by this, and the point of democracy is not to exhaust the citizens. So the citizens don't have to be heroic all the time.
Plus, a crackdown again in Hong Kong.
I just think they are just hanging a knife just above my head or on my neck, on my throat. And it is just a matter of time when they will cut it.
In Greece, churchgoers defy a government lockdown.
He walked down the aisle to sprinkle holy water on people, and people crowded around him to get his blessing. And then some people took their masks off and took turns kissing his hand.
I'm Carol Hills. That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Protesters storming government buildings, encouraged by leaders who refuse to let go of power. That's something Americans have seen in other countries, but not in Washington, D.C. The peaceful transition of power is one of the foundations of any democracy, and right now in the U.S., it's being challenged like never before. President Trump told crowds at a rally today that he would never concede, and he's continued to make baseless claims about a stolen election. This was already top of mind for many Americans today as Congress met to officially ratify the results of the vote in November. But the proceedings were disrupted when crowds of demonstrators surrounded, and then some even entered, the U.S. Capitol building itself. Authorities in Washington have announced a 6 p.m. curfew. How does all this look from outside of the United States? For a European viewpoint, we're joined by Konstanz Stelzenmüller. She's the Fritz Stern Chair on Germany and Transatlantic Relations at the Brookings Institution. Konstanz, you're often asked to explain Germany and German politics to Americans. In this moment, though, I'm sure you're being asked to explain American politics to Germans. What do you tell them?
What I tell them is that I'm living in this country for the third time in my life. I was here as a child because my dad was posted here as a diplomat, and I went to graduate school here. So on the one hand, I know that this country has a long tradition of managing traditions that to some Western European democracies may seem unbearably turbulent. But I also will say to you that nothing I have experienced has prepared me for this particular transition.
In what way?
Well, because of the extraordinary persistence, not just of the current president of the United States, but also of a significant number of senior members of the Republican Party and much of their base in adhering to false narrative, invented facts. That is profoundly troubling. And nobody in Europe, and certainly I don't think that this couldn't happen in Europe. So this, I think, is seen by many of us as writing on the wall, something to avoid.
How would you assess the state of U.S. democracy today, given these strange happenings?
Well, after last night's events in Georgia, and I would add a remarkably trouble-free and fair election on November the 3rd, I'd say it's a very mixed bag. It's clear that institutions and democracy have won out in the end, but there are a lot of truly troubling phenomena on the way. And I think that if I'm anything to go by, everybody is exhausted by this. And the point of democracy, the point of institutions and processes and laws, is not to exhaust the citizens. So the citizens don't have to be heroic all the time, like those people were who got out the vote in Georgia last night.
I have to ask you, you know, when you look around the world, look around in parts of Europe and parts of the U.S., you see this kind of drift. It's been well discussed, the drift toward authoritarianism, the drift toward intolerance. Are you seriously concerned about it, as far as the U.S. is concerned?
This is a hard one to answer because I'm very fond of this country, and this sort of is a question that goes to the heart and not just to the brain. And I'm also worried about quite similar phenomena in Europe, not least in my own country, Germany. I will say I am deeply troubled by some of the nastiness and meanness that we saw during the past 4 years, not just among ordinary people, but from elected politicians who ought to be held to the highest standards. And yet at the same time, I never cease to be amazed at the extraordinary grit, determination, and just sheer force of character that gets the vote out in this country, protects institutions and democratic processes, and ultimately ends up with good results that ought to be accepted by everybody. Do I worry about people demonstrating in Washington today? Yes, but as of now, it's not a very large group.
Do you think that in these countries that are kind of becoming more authoritarian, more intolerant, is it coming from below and a leader is then saying, okay, this is what people want, I'm going to become like this too? Or is it being started at the top and then citizens are going for it? Where's the impetus coming from in your mind?
Answer to that question is it's both. There is a rise of unrealistic expectation on the side of ordinary citizens. They seem to think of democracy as something that you can order on Amazon with one click and then it's delivered the next day. That is not how it works. Representative democracy in a modern society is laborious. It's an exercise in building consensus, in deferring to each other's views. And I worry that people have lost sight of the basic lessons of civics, that this is what democracy is about. It's not about you getting a maximum of what you want all of the time. And at the same time, clearly there are politicians who have caught on to this shift in how people think about their lives and who are exploiting cynically working class desires and fears and ambitions for their own purposes. And I think that this, frankly, quite terrifying 4-year interlude in American politics has been a wake-up call to all of us, not just in America, as friends of America, all of us who are citizens of Western democracies and democracies elsewhere, to consider our own responsibilities as citizens and voters, and where necessary, to rise up and defend it.
So what's the way forward? How do you defend it?
Oh, there are so many ways. I think one is to educate yourself, not succumb to fake news and disinformation. Understand what your political rights are. Understand how your local community works and what it needs. And if there's something wrong, figure out together with other voters and citizens how to find the best way to change that with legal and legitimate means. There are so many things that we can do. I think that, you know, that would be the subject of an entire day on radio and not just sort of one simple interview. Last night in Georgia has shown one thing. It is that people can change politics if they want to. And that's one of the great characteristics of American democracy. This is the thing I admire most about this country.
Constanze Stelzenmüller is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. I want to thank you for speaking with us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
While political unrest is unfolding in Washington, D.C. today, on the other side of the world, in Hong Kong, people spoke out against a government crackdown. A small group of politicians and activists held a press conference and chanted pro-democracy slogans in defiance of the Hong Kong government's latest move, where authorities arrested more than 50 pro-democracy advocates and former lawmakers. They're accused of attempting to, quote, overthrow the city's government. That's because the politicians and activists participated in an unofficial primary vote to select candidates ahead of postponed 2020 elections. Lo Khin Hay was one of the politicians at the press conference. He's the chair of Hong Kong's Democratic Party.
I was actually walked by a telephone call at around 6:30 this morning. That call is about one of my party member, a former legislator, being arrested, and then followed by another call, another legislator is arrested. And I started to tweet and help arranging lawyers to try to find out which police station they went to. And yeah, it has been a very long day for me. And I think it is a very long day for those who are arrested as well, and for a lot of Hong Kong people.
Tell us who was arrested and what they've been charged with.
They're using the charge of subversion under the national security law against 53 people. The rationale behind the arrest, they said, is those people, they participated in a primary among the pro-democracy side, and they see this as subversive acts to the state.
Of course, this is what everyone has been afraid of, and what Hong Kong officials have assured people would not happen. Why do you think you weren't arrested?
The so-called red lines, the taboos of the Beijing government, is a very fluid line. It is not written clearly what is not acceptable by the government or what is not acceptable by the Chinese government. It is always a political needs. So to me, I would just think at this point of time, the political needs of the Beijing government didn't strike me yet. So I think it is just a matter of time. I don't think I'm spared. I just think they are just hanging a knife just above my head or on my neck, on my throat. And it is just a matter of time when they will cut it.
Why is Hong Kong's government so threatened by this group of lawmakers and activists who've now been arrested?
I think they're really, really frightened that the Hong Kong people will vote the pro-democracy side and really take control of the Legislative Council. So to the Beijing government and to Hong Kong government, the threat of pro-democracy candidates getting the majority of the council is a real threat to them.
How big of a setback are today's police roundups to Hong Kong's pro-democracy movement?
It is a very dramatic one. Although we know that the national security law is a very sweeping weapon that they can use, but using it in this way really shocked a lot of Hong Kong people, and it really shocked me as well. We do have some fear, but if the Hong Kong people keep our faith and spirit, we shall finally get through this hardest time. I personally think that it is not the darkest hour yet. There will be some more, even more dramatic moves in the future. But we can only hang on and support each other and take care of each other and stand every possible ground. And so that in these kind of dark hours, we still have each other and we will hold on to each other.
Do you feel support from the United States?
I better not answer this. Because, you know, the national security law is a very widespread one. And I believe that if I answer this question, it will get me a lot of trouble. So I'd rather not answer this question.
Do you think a new administration with Joe Biden at the helm will offer key support?
I don't know. And these questions related to foreign government, whether they will support Hong Kong or not, it is quite obviously stated in the national security law that is very possible to be criminalized. So I'm sorry, I have to protect myself here.
Understood. Loh Kin Hay is the chair of Hong Kong's Democratic Party. He joined us from Hong Kong. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're with The World. In Greece today, church bells as the faithful flocked to Epiphany services. Epiphany is one of the most important holidays for Orthodox Christians. Every year on January 6th, they celebrate the baptism of Jesus Christ with services and other events. This year, because of the coronavirus, Greece is under a strict lockdown and some rituals were banned. But the church's top leadership instructed priests to defy government orders and hold services anyway. The World's Lydia Amanalidou is on the line from Athens. Lydia, did the services go on?
They did, all over Greece. So if you turn on Greek TV today or look at social media, you'll see videos of people crowding outside of churches, waiting to get in, people inside churches lining up to take communion, which in the Greek Orthodox Church is given through one single spoon for the entire congregation. I ventured out earlier today to see how things were going in my area. I went to Metropolitan Church of Athens, which is the largest church in the city. When I walked in, I counted about 45 people in the pews.
Good Lord. I mean, you mentioned a couple of things that I want to follow up on. I mean, one is, were people wearing masks and social distancing? But the single spoon thing, were people actually, everyone using the same spoon?
Yeah, so this is the way they give communion at Greek Orthodox churches. People line up and take turns drinking a mixture of wine and bread out of the same spoon. In terms of the social distancing and mask wearing, at the church where I was, the people in the pews were doing all that. The priests that were doing the services, though, there were eight of them, they were not wearing masks or social distancing. And one of them was actually Archbishop Hieronymus, who's the very head of the Greek Orthodox Church. He's 82 years old, and he was recently hospitalized with COVID. He was actually released from the hospital about a month ago, and at the end of the service, he walked down the aisle, you know, of the church in between the pews to sprinkle holy water on people, and people crowded around him to get his blessing. And then some people took their masks off and took turns kissing his hand and the cross he was holding.
Wow. I mean, I know there are really strict lockdown rules in Greece right now. Everything's closed. Why did the church defy government restrictions? Give us the backstory here.
Yeah, so we've been in a national lockdown since the beginning of November, and churches haven't been allowed to hold services. But a few weeks ago, the government decided to make some exceptions for a couple major Orthodox holidays, including Epiphany. So they said, fine, you can have services as long as you follow certain measures. But then this last weekend, the government changed its mind and said, never mind, you actually can't hold services. And the reason they did that is because they want to open schools this coming Monday. So they wanted things to be a little stricter for this week. Now, of course, the church didn't like that churches wouldn't be allowed to have Epiphany services. So they said, no, we're still going to open. We're not going to comply with the government's orders. And they instructed priests to defy the rules and hold services for believers.
I mean, has the Greek Orthodox Church ever done something like this before?
No. So we've seen rogue acts of defiance from Orthodox priests that would do things like hold services when they weren't supposed to or not enforce attendance limits. But to have the church's official governing body issue a directive basically telling people to go against the law is unprecedented.
So what about the flock? What was their response? Did people go ahead to these services or did a lot of people stay home?
A lot of people did come out for services all over Greece. And at the church where I went, I talked to people just as they were leaving. One man told me that as an Orthodox Christian, he felt like it was his duty to be at the church, and he was devastated when he thought he wouldn't be able to go. So he was really happy that the church made this decision today. I talked to another churchgoer, 82-year-old Eleni Pala, and I asked her if she was afraid to come to church.
Okay.
She said no, that even though she's in a vulnerable group and even though she has other health problems, she trusts God. Of course, there are people who are really critical of the church today who say the church isn't setting a good example and is encouraging risky behavior in a public health crisis. Epidemiologists have been saying they're worried that these kinds of gatherings will increase case numbers and that they'll undo some of the progress that we've made over the last couple months since we went into lockdown at the beginning of November. And then finally, people are also really angry with the government for essentially looking the other direction and letting the church have its way today.
The world's Lydia Emanuelidou in Athens. Thanks a lot, Lydia.
You're welcome, Carol.
COVID-19 has ravaged economies in Southeast Asia. Governments there are desperate to get their people vaccinated and move on. In the Philippines, President Rodrigo Duterte is giving an ultimatum to his longtime ally, the United States, saying, you know those U.S. troops stationed on our soil? If you don't give us millions of vaccines, I'll kick them out.
20 million vaccines. No vaccine, no, stay here.
No vaccine, no stay here. The world's Patrick Nguyen says the Philippines isn't the only country anxious to get its vaccines ASAP. Patrick, this ultimatum from Duterte, is it likely to work?
Probably not, Carol. I mean, it's hard to tell how serious he is because Duterte has this Trump-like speaking style that's very rambling and off the cuff, and you never really know whether he's declaring a policy or just trying to sound tough. But I do think there's two things you can take away from this. One is the deterioration of U.S. empire, because the Philippines is a former U.S. colony and has had this big brother, little brother relationship to the country for ages. And now that is becoming more of a crude transactional relationship with leaders like Duterte saying, the U.S. isn't so great anymore. Because in that same speech, he said, and I'm quoting here, "Don't believe that expletive about America being able to deliver vaccines anyway. They can't even deliver it to their own people." So there's that. And the other takeaway is that leaders across Southeast Asia, they might not be as blunt as Duterte, but they are also really worried about how and when they're going to get vaccines and end this pandemic.
Give us a reality check. How is the Philippines and other nearby nations coping with COVID-19?
It varies by country, but the two countries that are really suffering are the two large, more tropical island nations. So that's the Philippines and Indonesia. They have nearly 400 million people between them. And lots of people there were only scraping by before the pandemic. So they're not going to be able to afford to pay for vaccines. They're going to need free vaccines. And also, given the state of roads and hospitals, it's going to have to be one of those vaccines that can endure some type of heat, because it can't be one that has to be kept in super cold storage. In mainland Southeast Asia, the situation is not as dire. Vietnam has handled it like pros, hardly any deaths there. Thailand and Myanmar were cruising along fine until recently, but now there's a spike, and we're talking several hundred new cases per day. I think what all these countries fear is that even though their outbreaks might not be as bad as America, they're still not among the rich and powerful. And when it comes to vaccines, they're probably stuck way back in the line.
Have any of these countries that we're talking about contracted to get certain vaccines?
Yeah, they have. Each country is now trying to hammer out deals with Big Pharma, ordering some from Pfizer, others from AstraZeneca. Some have already arrived in very small numbers, but they're probably not going to get the bulk of them until late 2021. And even that's not going to be enough. More will have to come from Sinovac, that's the Chinese vaccine. China will presumably be pumping a lot of that out into Southeast Asia because Beijing doesn't want COVID rampaging in its backyard either. But Myanmar, the Philippines, they're saying they might get 20 or 25% of the population this year. That's it. And America's target is more like 70 or 80%. So they're going to be struggling with COVID-19 here years after the U.S. and Europe get back to normal.
The World's Patrick Nguyen speaking to us from Bangkok. Thanks a lot, Patrick.
Thanks, Carol.
This is The World. A valuable painting hangs in a Dutch museum. It was once part of a collection owned by a Jewish family. They say they were forced to sell it during the Nazi occupation.
No Jewish person in their right mind would take an art collection to an auction house that is complicit with the Nazis.
Question is, who should own the art now? That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. There's a light at the end of the pandemic tunnel, but it's closer for people in some parts of the world than others. So far, the U.S. and the U.K., for example, have vaccinated about 1.5% of their populations. In Israel, they're vaccinating about 1.5% of the population every day. So why is that country doing so well? The World's Ariel Osaran reports.
About 150,000 Israelis a day are getting the vaccine. New cases here have surged to a three-month high, but health authorities have still managed to vaccinate about 50% of the country's high-risk population. Israeli Health Minister Yuli Edelstein says the entire population could be vaccinated as soon as April. Israel's moving so fast, they're already planning for the day after the pandemic. On Monday, the health ministry unveiled its proposed green passport. It will grant Israelis who've been vaccinated permission to attend large gatherings and cultural events.
It's actually really an amazing project where everybody took part in it.
Gili Regev is the director of the infectious disease unit at the Sheba Medical Center, Israel's largest hospital. She says Israel's successful campaign is largely thanks to its community-based health system. By law, all Israelis must be registered with one of the country's four healthcare providers. And in a small country of 9 million people, Regev says, the vaccination effort has been a huge success.
And I think also the compliance of the population. You know, there was a lot of PR about this, on how important it is, and that this is really the only way to stop this pandemic. And I think all of those together is what actually made this happen. And yeah, it's really exciting.
Israel signed agreements with multiple drug companies for the vaccines, but it's distributing them faster than new shipments are arriving. The situation next door in the Palestinian West Bank, on the other hand, is very different. Outside the city of Nablus, Murad Shawer is a physician in charge at Hugo Chavez Hospital. That's where the most complicated COVID cases are sent from all across the West Bank. He and about 3 million other Palestinians living under Israeli military control will have to wait much longer for a vaccine.
It's very stressful for me and for all the personnel. We have now crossing the peak of the disease, and it will continue during the next 3 months at least.
Numbers of new cases are going down, Shawar says, and a vaccine will have an impact. But there's a hitch.
I think vaccine can help to get our target, but now I don't know how much time we have to wait to get this vaccine.
The Palestinian Authority is strapped for cash, and it has yet to sign a single deal with a vaccine manufacturer. But Palestinian officials say it's a top priority.
We are in contact with Pfizer, with Sputnik V, with the AstraZeneca, with all the manufacturers.
Ali Abdrabo is the Director General of the Palestinian Health Ministry.
The only one signed is with the COVAX facility. That will provide 20% of the Palestinian population.
COVAX is the initiative co-led by the World Health Organization to distribute COVID-19 vaccines more equally around the world. Abdrabo says he hopes the first vaccines will arrive next month, but he doesn't seem too optimistic about that time frame. He says there is a dialogue with Israel to facilitate the entry of the vaccines once they arrive.
But I think that there is a responsibility for Israel, who is under the international law, is the occupying force, to provide all these vaccines and all the needs of the peoples in the occupied territories.
In Israel, there's a debate about what legal responsibility it has toward the Palestinians during the pandemic. But what about the moral question? Dr. Regev from Sheba Hospital tells me that Israel should be doing more to help get the vaccines to the Palestinians.
Definitely, I think we should. And, you know, there is the Israeli vaccine, which is also being developed. And some people said, well, why do we need to develop it if, you know, we have enough vaccines? Obviously, we need to develop because the world needs vaccines. You know, I think everybody should put an effort in developing the vaccines and distributing them and vaccinating all of the populations in need.
Israel's health minister recently said that the government's first obligation was to its own citizens. As for the Palestinians, he said, quote, if, God willing, there's a situation where we can help, it will be done. For the World, I'm Ariel Osaran in Tel Aviv.
Yesterday, we brought you some reporting from Sudan about how the country is struggling economically. It's been 1 year since protests there toppled the longtime dictator Omar al-Bashir. Today, Sudan's cash-strapped government announced a breakthrough on debt relief. It signed an agreement with the U.S. to have its World Bank debts forgiven and to normalize relations with the State of Israel. Treasury Secretary Stephen Mnuchin was in the Sudanese capital Khartoum for today's signing ceremony.
Thank you for all the important work on the Abraham Accords. I think this is a very, very significant agreement. This is now the third that I've participated in being part of the signing. It's a great honor to be here with you today, and I think we'll have a tremendous impact on the people of Israel and the people of Sudan as they continue to work together on cultural and economic opportunities.
Last month, President Trump notified Congress that he planned to remove Sudan from the list of state sponsors of terrorism. The country had been on the list since 1993 for supporting Palestinian militants and hosting al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden. Now, Sudan will join Bahrain, Morocco, and the United Arab Emirates by agreeing to normalize relations with Israel. Sudanese Justice Minister Nasreddine Abdelbari said today that these agreements, known as the Abraham Accords, are an opportunity for the whole region. Abdelbari said today's announcement will help bring peace, tolerance, and respect to different nations. That's good news for U.S. national security interests, says Cameron Hudson. He's with the Atlantic Council's Africa Center.
Sudan, which for 30 years was ruled by an autocratic dictator exporting instability across the region, now standing as something of a beacon of hope for what a successful democratic transition might look like, brought about by a people's-led revolution. So Sudan all of a sudden has the possibility to be a real model in the region.
Hudson says debt relief is a huge deal for Sudan's new civilian-led government, but the change will be felt across the country.
For regular people, what that's going to do is it's going to increase the capitalization and the liquidity of the Sudanese economy. And so what that means is the price of everyday goods begins to go down. People's access to services and products in the economy goes up. The heavy burden of trying to find capital to start a business, to get tuition to send your children to school, that becomes easier as debt relief becomes a reality for Sudan.
Sudan has felt the impact of the conflict in Ethiopia's northern Tigray region. The fighting broke out in early November. Since then, the Ethiopian government has claimed victory. But reports of fighting with the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or TPLF, have continued. The violence is believed to have killed thousands of people and caused more than 50,000 Ethiopians to flee across the border into neighboring Sudan. They've been sharing their stories of war, but also of hope. The World's Africa correspondent, Halima Gikandi, reports from eastern Sudan.
The Hamdiyat Transit Center for Refugees is crowded. Thousands of Ethiopians have passed through here in the last 2 months, fleeing the conflict in Tigray. This corner of Sudan is blazing hot during the day, chilly at night, and daily necessities are scarce. But Abebu Habdu is all smiles. She's holding her newborn daughter. Habtu comes from Humara in the Tigray region of Ethiopia. She tells me how in November, residents from the town of Maikadra arrived there. They told terrifying stories of murder and violence. She and her family decided not to take any chances and to flee. Habtu says she was heavily pregnant when they crossed the Tekeze River that separates Sudan from Ethiopia. A week later, she gave birth in a foreign land around foreign people. On one side of her, she says, were white foreigners, likely working with humanitarian organizations. On the other, Sudanese midwives from the surrounding host community. When they asked her what she wanted to name her daughter, Habtu says she was exhausted, distressed, so she told them to choose a name. The white people suggested the name Hope, which in Habtu's local language is pronounced Tesfa. The Sudanese midwives suggested Salam. That's Arabic for peace. Habtu says she liked both names, so that's what she named her daughter, Tesfa Salam, symbolizing her own hope that one day there will be peace. Habtu says she doesn't expect the conflict in Tigray to be over anytime soon. She says she'll stay here in Sudan until it's safe to return. As we finished speaking, Habtu had one last message of gratitude to Sudan for welcoming more than 56,000 refugees. Here at the border, ordinary Sudanese people have shown up offering clothes, food, and even housing to the refugees. I hope that generosity will continue, Habtu tells me. For the world, I'm Halima Gikandi, Hamdayat, Sudan.
A few months ago, social media picked up on the theme of so-called forest cities. That was after President Trump praised Austria for how it manages its forests to avoid catastrophic wildfires.
Austria, you look at so many countries, they live in the forest. They're considered forest cities, so many of them. And they don't have fires like this, and they have more explosive trees.
Austrian government officials clarified, Austria does not have exploding trees. Many had a laugh at Trump's word choices, but the president did have a point. Countries like Austria and Germany haven't seen extreme fires like California or Australia in recent years. Amanda Peacher tells us why that is.
In a region of Austria known as the Wood Quarter, a logger uses a chainsaw to slice through the base of a 100-foot-tall spruce tree. Forester Herbert Schmid watches from a distance as the big spruce drops to the forest floor. Schmid says he hand-picked that particular tree to be cut today.
Because the trees that we see here are already so tall and need space.
This part of the forest is shady and dense, and he wanted to open up the canopy. The logger uses a tractor-like machine called a harvester to divide the fallen tree into long logs. There are all sizes and species of trees here. Tall, looming firs, tiny spruce saplings with bright green needles, even cherry trees. And Schmid says that species diversity is one reason this forest is fire resilient.
The more tree variety, the more stable it is. It doesn't matter whether it's fire or storm or snow. If I've only one kind of tree and they're all the same exact height, it's prone to any disaster.
More than half of Austria and one-third of Germany is forest. This land is owned by the Stift Altenburg Monastery in Lower Austria. Logging revenue is a huge part of the monastery's funding. But this is not a typical timber operation. Schmid manages this area as a pro silva, or close to nature, forest.
Natural management is a play with light and shadow. Enough light for the small trees, but not so much that plants like elderberry can take over. You always have to look how much light comes through the crowns of the old trees, and that is the art.
When the forest needs more light, it's time to cut down some trees. Forestry experts say it's a good model. Alexander Held is a senior expert with the European Forest Institute.
With ProSilva forestry, you try to mimic that small-scale disturbance with small-scale harvesting.
Held explains you selectively cut down trees that might otherwise die because of lightning, old age, or bark beetles.
And in these gaps where the old trees fell, died, you have regeneration of very different tree species.
Close-to-nature forests tend to be lush and moist. In other words, not places that are quick to burn. Still, there are many forests across Central Europe that are not managed like this.
Traditional forestry primitive approach is you harvest, you replant. So that there is always enough supply of timber.
Austria and Germany tend to be cooler and rainier, and that's one reason why they haven't had catastrophic wildfires recently. But it's also luck. Climate change is causing hotter, drier summers in Central Europe. And Held says in those conditions, dense monoculture forests are like a matchbox.
Oh my God, if this goes up in flame, you're sitting on a time bomb.
That's why Held believes the ProSilva method is a good model as foresters prepare for more hot and dry weather.
This is actually a little secret that makes sense to show to the world.
In the Stift Altenburg Forest in Lower Austria, there's another little secret to share from close-to-nature forestry. That's the sound of a Eurasian jaybird. Herbert Schmidt says these native birds are essentially his forest workers. They plant new trees.
Now the idea was that we collect seeds in our oak forests and put them in the bird feeder. The birds know the food is there, and they take the seeds and hide them in the forest.
The jaybirds forget about some of their seed stashes. And in just a couple of years, Schmidt says this bird army helped plant 25,000 new trees and create a more diverse, fire-resilient landscape. Schmidt says natural management techniques are also cheap. He's not paying for herbicides or human labor to plant trees. It's actually a return to ancient techniques that he says work. For The World, I'm Amanda Peacher in Lower Austria.
There's been a global spotlight on Georgia today, and The World's election project, Every 30 Seconds, has been closely following the growing voice of the Latino community there, from misinformation to get-out-the-vote efforts. You can find more of our reporting on Georgia, that's all at theworld.org/every30seconds. A painting by the modern master Vasily Kandinsky hangs in the Stedelijk Museum in Amsterdam. It's called Painting with Houses, and it once belonged to a Jewish family before World War II. The heirs say the painting was sold under duress during the Nazi occupation, and now they want it back. Last month, a Dutch court ruled that the painting will stay at the museum, upholding a 2018 decision by the Dutch Restitution Commission. When our reporter Sarah Birnbaum started looking into this story, she thought it was going to be straightforward. But the more she dug into it, the murkier and more morally ambiguous it became.
Let's start with what we know. The painting belonged to a Jewish businessman named Emanuel Lewenstein and his wife Hedwig. They were art collectors in the Netherlands before the war. When the couple died in 1930 and 1937, they left their collection to their two children, Robert and Wilhelmina. Then the Nazis invaded the Netherlands in 1940. Robert and Wilhelmina fled the country and never came back. Then there's a gap in the records. The next thing we know, 5 months after the German invasion, the entire art collection, including the Kandinsky painting, shows up at auction. It's an auction house that's been known to collaborate with the Nazis. There's no record of who put the works up for auction, why the works are put up for auction, or what happened to the proceeds. We know the museum bought the work at a cut-rate price, about the equivalent of 1,000 euros today, and it's been at the Stedelijk ever since. In 2013, the heirs filed a claim with the Dutch Restitution Commission to get the painting back. Attorney James Palmer represents the family. He says they don't have all the evidence, but it's pretty easy to put two and two together here.
It's very difficult to find all the evidence, all the pieces to this puzzle, but we found enough so that a reasonable person can make, you know, logical and reasonable conclusion.
And that conclusion? That the painting was stolen or, at the very least, a forced sale.
No Jewish person in their right mind would take an art collection of 100 artworks to an auction house that is complicit with the Nazis in the top auction house in Amsterdam and start organizing a very conspicuous sale of its prized property and possessions. It doesn't make any sense.
But the Restitution Commission came to a different conclusion. The commission wouldn't be interviewed because of ongoing litigation, but its findings are outlined in a 22-page written decision. It says there's no evidence the painting was stolen. The commission thinks the Kandinsky went to the son, Robert Lewenstein, and his wife, Irma. The marriage was rocky, and they separated. Robert went to France with his new girlfriend. Irma stayed behind in the Netherlands. That's all documented. So the commission concluded Irma was short on funds, so she made arrangements to sell the collection. The commission says the auction itself was above board and there was no theft. Both those stories seem plausible to me. So who's right? I called an outside expert, Christoph Zuschlag. He's an art historian at the University of Bonn, and he specializes in tracing art looted by the Nazis. He wasn't involved in this case, and he wasn't privy to all the documents the commission used.
However, as far as I know, there's nothing to suggest that the Lewenstein family voluntarily parted with the work.
He doesn't think the family voluntarily sold the work. On the other hand, he says it's interesting. He thinks Irma was probably the one who brought the paintings to the auction house. And after the war, Irma stayed in Amsterdam, and she never tried to get the painting back. She stayed on good terms with the Stedelijk Museum.
She gave the Stedelijk Museum artworks as permanent loans after 45. So this could be a sign that she did not have the feeling that she had to give away the painting under persecution. You understand?
Because yeah, she doesn't think
it
was stolen. This
is no proof for anything. It's just...
Right, that's my question. Like, what do you do with these conjectures? I mean, is it... How do you weigh all these things?
This is one of the most difficult questions you're raising in such cases.
It's really difficult. So to resolve this case, the Restitution Commission turned to a controversial tool. It's called the balance of interest test. The commission decided that the Kandinsky was more important to the museum than to the heirs, so the painting can stay at the Stedelijk.
The balance of interest test is absolutely ludicrous.
James Palmer, the Lewinstein's lawyer, says what the museum wants shouldn't be factored in, and lots of restitution experts agree with him. A Dutch government panel even agrees with him. The commission started using the balance of interest test in 2013, and last month, a committee established by the Dutch Minister of Culture recommended getting rid of it. It said the Restitution Commission should take a more empathetic approach towards victims. Christoph Zuschlag, the expert in looted art, explained what was behind that criticism.
The basic idea, I would say, is we cannot undo the Holocaust, but we can at least try to compensate the victims or their heirs nowadays, right?
He says that's why the interest of the museum is beside the point. But I can see the other side of the argument. And I say this as a grandchild of four Holocaust survivors. Of course, if an artwork is stolen by the Nazis, it should be returned to the heirs, regardless of how important it is to the museum or to the art-going public. But in the Lewinstein case, where there's so much ambiguity, I think you can make a utilitarian moral argument that the importance of the painting to the public and to art history should factor in. I put this to Zuschlag.
I see your point, but this may not be the reason to decide against a restitution if it's looted.
What if you're not sure if the artwork is looted?
Yeah.
Then the balance of interest should still probably not factor in.
Yes, not sure. I think I could agree with that.
Then what if most of the evidence points to the fact that it was a fair sale?
Yeah.
Should the balance of interest still not come in? It's not beyond a shadow of a doubt. It's just most of it. Should we still not do the balance of interest?
I'm not sure. To be honest, yeah. I'm not sure.
It's tough. Then, of course, you have the issue of what it means for an artwork to be stolen. Can any sale of Jewish art in Nazi-occupied Europe be entirely voluntary? As for the Lewinstein case, the lawyers tried to get the Restitution Commission's decision overturned in Amsterdam court. It didn't work, and now they plan to appeal. The case will be closely watched because advocates say there are tens of thousands of artworks in Dutch collections that were stolen from Jews during the Holocaust. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. See you back here tomorrow. From PR.